listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The administration of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney is certain to become one of the most studied in American history. The September 11th attacks, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the housing bubble and subprime mortgage crisis, Hurricane Katrina. Whatever we think of the Bush-Cheney White House, it's 8 years in office with tumultuous and pivotal times. Peter Baker covered the Clinton and Bush administrations for the Washington Post, and since 2008, he has been chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. He offers the first really comprehensive chronicle of the Bush-Cheney years in his book called Days of Fire, which is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Baker back to our show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. It's great.
Did you set out to assess the administration's performance or to establish facts for others to assess?
It's more the latter. I think that this is what we find, I think, as reporters covering a White House like the Bush White House, is you get maybe 10-20% of what's really going on. And it's only after the fact, after it's over, if you go back and talk to people and get them to be more honest, you get a better sense of what really happens.
But can the two really be separated, especially when so many still dispute key points? For example, how administration members may have misrepresented facts in the lead-up to the Iraq War?
Well, some things are going to be controversial forever, but that is the reason why it's important to give people sort of a straight look at the facts, and then they can come to their own conclusions after you present it to them, and that's what we try to do in Days of Fire.
Well, many of them are written memoirs. How much did you rely on those memoirs?
Well, I did a lot. Everybody's got a memoir in this administration, probably more out of this administration than any previous one. And so,
also, we should assume that they're self-serving, as
they
most
are.
Memoirs
sure,
are.
Of course. They're one person's point of view, and one person's point of view only. And in fact, often they're quite in conflict with each other. So that's why you need somebody to come along and sort of reconcile them, try to put them all together and come up with a single coherent narrative.
And then I assume interview people and ask them, is this true? Did this really
Absolutely.
Happen?
Yeah. We did about 400 interviews, 275 people involved in the administration. And I think what comes out of it is a rather surprising story.
Well, how much of it was conflicting information?
Well, considerably. You know, again, people walk out of the meeting and remember different things. You and I might finish this interview and walk out, and you and I might remember it in a different way, right? Very natural. So you try to get documents, memos, talk to as many people in the room as possible to really kind of nail down as best you can what really happened. But history, of course, is always a matter of debate, and that's why we took such a strong look at it.
Well, now it's 5 years since George Bush left office. So that allows us some perspective, but not the same kind of perspective that 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Right, right. The archives aren't open yet. Someday we'll get a whole trove of information. What will be really interesting about this one is they're not tapes like Nixon or JFK or LBJ, but there will be emails. This is going to be the first administration where emails were a really prevalent part of that administration. I can't wait to read them.
But do you think we've gotten past the passions of that surrounded the Bush years?
No, not entirely. I think people feel very strongly still, as probably they should. They're very important issues that were debated and raised then. But I do think there's been some softening of the passions, and because of the current passions about what's going on in the current administration, people look back with a little different eye to the last one.
You open and close with Scooter Libby convicted of a felony in connection with the leak of Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA officer. Did Bush's attitudes toward Libby exemplify how his relationship with Cheney evolved over their 8 years together?
Well, I do think that by the end, they're talking about whether Scooter Libby should be pardoned or not. And this is the final break after years of a divergence between the two. They're on the opposite sides of so many different issues, foreign policy, economic policy, domestic policy, that when the vice president comes to Cheney, to Bush in the last few weeks and says, I think you ought to give a pardon to Scooter Libby, and Bush refuses, it's a real final break in their eight-year partnership.
Well, you talk about the major differences. Most people assume that they were in agreement on so many things. In fact, they've often described this as the Cheney presidency.
Right, the co-presidency or the president, exactly. And that's what's surprising, I think. That's what's surprising about the story that comes out of Days of Fire is, in fact, it's a much more fluid relationship, much more dynamic, and much more surprising than people realize.
So Libby was sentenced to 30 months in prison. Bush commuted the prison sentence.
He did, yes.
Was that a consolation prize for Cheney after the president declined to pardon him?
Well, he committed it in 2007 when the verdict first came out and he was about to go to prison. He said, that's too far, but I'm not going to question the verdict of the jury itself. And so then 18 months later, Cheney comes to him and say, well, I think you still should give him a pardon because he can't practice law. His name is tarred through history. This is a bogus prosecution. Bush sends the lawyers to go back and relook at it, and they come back and say, well, we think the jury had reason to find the verdict it did.
And what is Scooter Libby doing these days?
He's in Washington. He's a part of a think tank down there, the Hudson Institute. He had an op-ed in the Washington Journal recently.
So he landed on his feet.
Yeah, but he's an unhappy man, I think, about what happened to him, and he feels that he was unfairly tarnished and he can't practice law.
Were you able to talk to Bush or Cheney?
Vice President Cheney did talk to me, as did Condi Rice and Don Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, David Petraeus, lots of other key figures. President Bush chose not to. He said that a couple things. One is that he thinks history won't be able to really judge him until he's long gone. And secondly, he didn't think a New York Times reporter would necessarily be fair to him. And I tried to convince him otherwise, but he stuck to his guns on that.
Well, that goes back to even before they were elected to office. There was that whole business during the 2000 campaign when Cheney made a remark to Bush about Adam Clymer of the New York Times.
Yeah, no, that's true. They did. They were at a campaign event, and Bush leans over and says, there's Adam Clymer, Major League, and then he uses a phrase I won't use on the air. And
thank you.
And Cheney says, yeah, big time. In fact, Adam actually sent me an email just today recalling the stories that got them sort of upset in the lead-up to that moment in 2000.
But it's interesting that the Times has been criticized for actually being a little soft on the Bush administration. You had the Judith Miller reports on the lead-up to the war in Iraq and others. And then the Times has also been criticized for missing the story on the housing bubble and financial crisis. So what did they think of their coverage for these two, the biggest crisis of their administration?
Yeah, I think, you know, it depends. I mean, look, you can criticize the Times from all sorts of directions. There are plenty of people who criticize us from the left and plenty of people who can criticize us for the right. And some of the things we did miss and get wrong, there's no question about it. It's a collection of human beings who are going to make mistakes. But I think that overall, our goal is to be both tough and fair with every administration.
Well, I wasn't asking about the Times. I was asking about what, considering the fact that they seem to be rather gung-ho in support of the invasion of Iraq, did that soften their opinion of the New York Times, or did they still see it as the enemy?
I think they saw it as not in their favor. I mean, there certainly were stories that they helped perpetuate in the lead up to the war, some of the intelligence that turned out to be wrong. And they view the New York Times as an important organ, that if they wrote about things about this intelligence, it would help their cause. But in the end, I don't think they saw the newspaper as a friend.
My guest is Peter Baker. His book, Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. Bush went to the White House straight from being governor of Texas. And apart from being the son of a former president, what experience did he have in Washington?
Well, he did help his father run for president in 1987-88. Was the loyalty enforcer, if you will, in the campaign. And I think that's when he met Cheney. Neither of them really remembers today when it was, but I tracked down records of a meeting in June of 1987 when he's going to the Hill to gather support for his father, and he goes to four different congressmen this particular day, and one of them was a Wyoming congressman named Dick Cheney, and that seems to be the first time the two of them ever met.
Well, he had been an insider. He'd been he had worked in Washington for over 25 years before they were elected in 2000.
Yes, Cheney did. Yes, he was White House Chief of Staff under Ford. He was a congressman for 10 years, defense secretary for Bush's father. So he was, in fact, the experienced hand.
Do you think that Bush saw him as somebody who, because of that experience, would really be helpful?
Yeah, I think he looked at him as reassuring both to the country in 2000 during the election and reassuring to him once he got in office. He recognized he didn't know much about national security coming in and that was Cheney's strength.
And also, do you think that he was looking for something different than what his father had gone through, the embarrassment of Dan Quayle, who couldn't even who made embarrassing spelling mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, look, Cheney is the unquail, and you know, nobody was going to mistake him for a lightweight. Nobody's going to call him anything other than a serious and experienced figure. So, I think that's right. He did sort of take away from his father's experience that way. He had actually urged his father to dump Dan Quayle in 1992 and put on the ticket his defense secretary, Dick Cheney, which obviously his father didn't do.
Well, he also sought to set himself apart from his father in other ways, and many people feel that the invasion of Iraq was an attempt to correct his father's mistake.
Right, or finish what his father didn't finish and so forth. I don't know that would have been his course of action prior to 9/11. He clearly came into office thinking Iraq was the major national security threat. They had ideas about regime change, but not putting American troops on the ground. 9/11 sort of accelerated and really created a whole different context.
Well, it is pointed out that that Cheney and Rumsfeld and some others, in fact, Jeremy Scahill has reported that they were determined to go to war with Iraq before the 9/11 attacks. You say he didn't. Bush didn't share that attitude.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that they, you know, they thought maybe they could have, perhaps, but that was not. There was no popular support for that kind of a thing. In fact, Rumsfeld writes a memo in July of 2000 saying, "Hey, we ought to think about different options, including military options." Nobody even responds to the memo. And I found an oral history that Dick Cheney gave in 2000, just before going on the ticket. Nobody'd ever seen it because it was sealed until after they left office. And he's asked about the 91 war and whether they made the right decision in not going to Baghdad. And he said they did. He said they shouldn't have gone to Baghdad because it would have had sectarian strife and owned a big quagmire. So even a year before 9/11, he still saw it that way.
And then, in effect, he was predicting what happened after they went into Iraq.
He did, yeah.
Well, Seymour Hersh and Willis Hilton reported that Cheney and Rumsfeld undermine the existing intelligence apparatus. What is your sense of how Cheney handled intelligence?
Well, he was a very aggressive consumer of intelligence. He'd been on the Intelligence Committee in Congress. He had his own ideas about it. He believed from the 91 war that they had underestimated at that time Saddam Hussein's genuine capacity. So when in 2001 and 2002 and 2003, he was inclined to see the worst possible interpretation of all the intelligence, and anybody who said otherwise, he thought was not seeing the same lesson that he saw from the 91 war.
Cheney is often cited as the most powerful vice president in American history. Do you think he was?
I think he was. Of course, it's sort of a sorry lot, and not very hard to be, right? We didn't give our vice presidents much to do for the longest time. It wasn't even until Walter Mondale they even had an office in the West Wing. So Cheney redefined the job with Bush's assent and approval, and I think every vice president to come will be more significant as a result.
Well, Barton Gellman and Joe Becker of the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize for their series on the Cheney vice presidency, and they reinforced the view that Dick Cheney dominated President Bush. But I'm getting a sense from you that you feel that they were overstating their case?
Oh, no. I'm a big fan of Bart and Joe, both friends of mine. I think they wrote a fantastic series, and Bart wrote a great book out of it. I think that the relationship, though, doesn't stay static. There's no question that Cheney was very influential at the beginning. He won more battles than he lost. But by the second term, he and Bush moved in very different directions, and Cheney was losing more of the battles than he won.
When he was being considered as Bush's running mate, doctors affirmed that Cheney was in, quote, good health with normal cardiac function, even though he'd had his fourth heart attack during the 2000 recount. Were the doctors pressured to misrepresent Cheney's condition?
That's not what the doctors say. They don't say they were pressured, but the doctor that Bush asked to look into it only made a phone call to Cheney's doctor and didn't actually do a separate exam himself. And with only that information, said Cheney was good enough to run, which obviously is a somewhat, you know, scant way to look at it, I suppose.
And Cheney obviously felt that he was fit enough to run.
He did, but obviously his heart did play a role. By the end of the administration, he was physically weak. He couldn't walk upstairs. He was nodding off in meetings. He had his fifth heart attack soon after leaving office, and it did make a difference. And in fact, he signed a letter of resignation just in case he became incapacitated and gave it to his aide and said, give this to the president in case I can't, do my job.
Peter Baker is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, a regular panelist on Washington Week on PBS, and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Breach, about Bill Clinton's impeachment. Also with his wife, Susan Glasser, Kremlin Rising, about Vladimir Putin's Russia. The book we are discussing is Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. It is published by Doubleday, and we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Peter Baker. His latest book, Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House, published by Doubleday. So how did they get along before the election and the early days of the administration? They barely knew each other.
Yeah, they didn't know each other very well. They were not friends. When I interviewed Vice President Cheney, he said, in fact, to me, we were not buddies. They didn't hunt together. They didn't fish together. It was a professional relationship.
And people were amused when Dick Cheney, who led the search for a running mate, decided to choose himself.
Right. Look, you know,
then Bush said, okay.
Well, Bush actually was pursuing him for several months. In fact, he had sent his own aide, Joe Alba, to go see Vice President Cheney, not then Vice President, obviously, in March of 2000, saying, I want you to be on the ticket. And Cheney initially said no, but he agreed to do the search committee. And obviously changed his mind over time, decided it was a job he could do something with.
Well, Cheney is only 5 years older than Bush, but he seems like he's a generation older.
Right, exactly. I think I surprise people. I make money asking people to guess how many years apart they are in age, and people never say five. So, but look, you know, he had a whole lifetime of experience that Bush didn't have, as you point out. Bush didn't get started really till later in life. He only quit drinking when he was 40, didn't make much in business. It wasn't until the Texas Rangers came along that he began to become something of a success.
But he also feels young.
He does.
He comes across as young, whereas Cheney, especially since he talks out of the side of his mouth, looks like he's one of an old-time Paul.
He's got a grimmer persona, obviously, a little more stoic, a little less, a little more removed. And Bush is a more outgoing boy, a more like frat, you know, sometimes frat boy, but also very engaging and charming in his own way.
Now let's talk a bit about how they have come to assess the war in Iraq. There was that famous mission accomplished assertion on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, 2003. Does Bush still think that the Iraq war was a success?
Well, he's never, as far as I can tell, with anybody in public or private, said he regrets doing it. He does regret aspects of it. Certain parts of the strategy obviously didn't work out, right? He regrets that they didn't do better planning. He regrets they didn't send more troops early on.
Does he blame Rumsfeld for that?
You know, he's very careful not to say that. Obviously, in the end, he got rid of Rumsfeld after 2006. But what he said is, look, Rumsfeld executed the strategy that I approved. And if it was, you know, if anybody should have changed it, it should have been me. And it takes him 3 years to really do that.
What about Cheney? He seems to still be gung-ho for the war.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what reasons does he give?
Cheney's never stopped his never varied from his very strong belief that Iraq was a threat to the United States. Still believes that it was the right thing to do, and doesn't, in fact, express a lot of regrets that others see.
But in looking over the situation at the time or later, it seems to me that Iran, North Korea would be greater threats.
Yeah, no, that's right. And obviously those are threats that still remain undealt with today. The diplomacy has kept them in a box to some extent, but not fully realized. We see Obama struggling with it right now.
But Dick Cheney never said, let's invade North Korea.
No, not so far as I could tell.
Perhaps because he knew that a war against Saddam Hussein was winnable and easily winnable, and North Korea would be a real problem.
North Korea would be a much different beast.
Iran
absolutely.
As well.
Yeah.
Cheney defended waterboarding, but publicly, President Bush said, and I'm quoting, this government does not torture people. Was the president denying the facts? Was he out of the loop, or was he convinced that waterboarding isn't torture?
Well, it's the latter. He gave direct and explicit permission to do some of the things that they did with these interrogations, and they defined torture to mean something different than a lot of other people define it, and don't include waterboarding in it. And I asked Cheney about this. I said, look, even if you think it's the right thing to have done for protection of the country, was there any part of it, any part of you that felt uncomfortable about it, any part of you that felt queasy about it? Again, even if you thought it was the right thing, he says, no, not at all. He says he had no regrets about it whatsoever.
And he was directly involved in approving waterboarding.
Well, he was part of the team that approved and defended it, and he to this day thinks it was the right thing to do, says it protected the country.
Should we assume that they agreed on all the other things, like the treatment of prisoners?
Well, they did agree on most of those things in that first term. I mean, Cheney, of course, outmaneuvers his rivals, Condi Rice and Colin Powell, to go to Bush with a military commission order that Bush signs without a full process. But by the second term, they do begin to disagree rather significantly on some of these things.
The Abu Ghraib photos became public in early 2004. Did the news have any effect on the Bush strategy for the elections that were coming up later that year?
Well, I think they were very obviously damaging to the election, and they tried very hard to distance themselves from it, to say this has nothing to do with the program that they had approved. This is just rogue officers. But it caused a lot of consternation. Rumsfeld offered to resign twice. Bush was fairly cynical about those offers, saw them as sort of a way of actually outmaneuvering him, but didn't accept them.
And in the end, it didn't hurt because although there is an argument could be made that Bush did not win the first election, the Supreme Court gave him that election, he did win the second election.
Yeah, look, he ran on a national security platform. The country was still obviously quite shaken by 9/11, looking around a world that they saw as dangerous and believed that he would do a somewhat better job with that.
And now we're hearing that Barack Obama's, some of the insiders were wondering whether Joe Biden shouldn't be dumped from the ticket and Hillary Clinton be put on it. Was Bush determined to keep Cheney on as vice president in 2004?
It's a great question. In fact, Cheney actually offered three times to drop off the ticket in 2004. He recognized that his utility was somewhat gone since Bush no longer needed an experienced hand. And Bush thought about it. He gave it, even came up with a replacement, Bill Frist, the senator from Tennessee. And the reason he said he thought about it was really interesting. He said it's just, in part, it would show who's really in charge, which tells you how sensitive he was by that point at the notion that Cheney was really the puppet master. But ultimately, he decided not to.
But in the end, you're saying that the dynamic between them had changed, and it was not as friendly as it had been.
Well, it did. It began. They began to move apart. Bush began moving more toward diplomacy in the second term with North Korea, Syria, Iran. And he also began compromising on some of these counterterrorism programs that were so controversial in terms of surveillance, interrogation, and detention.
Well, they worked together on other things, on nominations. Bush nominated two of the most conservative Supreme Court justices, John Roberts and Samuel Alito, but he initially nominated Harriet Myers to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, and that ended up going badly for the administration. Was there a split in the administration of Myers?
There was. Cheney was against that nomination, didn't think it was a good idea. And it turns out the real reason that they finally dropped her was because when the lawyers went to prepare her for Senate hearings, they discovered how little she really understood about things like the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment, things that are very basic to constitutional law. It wasn't her background. She was a corporate lawyer, not a constitutional scholar, and they thought she would be crucified if she went up to the Hill.
Also, a lot of the criticism of Myers came from conservatives.
It
kind of almost suggests what's going to come later with the creation of the Tea Parties in the Republican Party.
Well, they saw Myers as a betrayal. They didn't understand what Bush was doing in nominating her. That was a noisy part of that episode, but it wasn't really what killed her. What really stopped her nomination was this concern about her preparation and the fact that she wasn't up to the questioning she would be getting.
Was there a war going on within the administration? You mentioned Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice taking different positions from Rumsfeld and Cheney.
Right.
And then Cheney had his own little kitchen cabinet, didn't he?
Yeah, they were definitely a team of rivals, no question about it. At one point, Colin Powell's deputy, Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, even urges him to resign, saying, look, they're just using you as cover to do the things that you don't want to do. You should step down. And Powell decided not to. He didn't leave until after the first term because he felt he had to be a good soldier.
Well, considering how far he's gone since supporting Barack Obama and taking positions that even some Democrats won't take today.
Right.
Perhaps, do you think he was already having second thoughts, or do you think that he's gone through his own personal transformation
it was clearly a scarring experience for him, particularly going before the UN with the intelligence that turned out to be false on Iraq. I think he feels like that was a very, to him, an unfairly tarnishing moment that he can't quite get back.
Peter Baker has been the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times since 2008, and his latest book is Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. It is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A year into the second term, Bush replaced White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card with Joshua Bolton, and there was a confrontation between Bolton and Cheney. Bolton rebuked Cheney. He said, if we have another episode like this, I will make sure that all of your belongings in your mail are forwarded to your tiny office in the Senate, and you won't be welcome back inside the gates of the White House.
Right.
What had happened? That was pretty strong.
That's the Cheney's chief of staff, just to be clear, not to the Cheney himself. But he was mad that Cheney had signed on to a brief that Senate Republicans had filed to the Supreme Court in the Second Amendment case that was different than what the administration had filed. And he basically saying, you can't do that. You can't have a different position than the administration you're part of. And he said, well, I signed it as my role of president of the Senate. And he sent him to his chief of staff, David Addington, and he told Addington this. And Addington says, well, you know, this was his role, chief of the Senate. He says, yeah, well, fine. Then if this happens again, you can go up there in the Senate.
Addington was another figure that many people were suspicious of.
Very powerful figure, chief of staff to the vice president after Scooter Libby. Very dominant figure in all the legal decisions that became so questioned later on.
So how did Cheney respond to Bolton?
Well, Cheney, he kind of smiled and said, fine, you're free to go talk to Addington. I think by that point, he was pretty discouraged by the administration. One of his aides told me that the signing of onto that Second Amendment brief was his way of saying, you know, basically blank you to the rest of the White House.
Joshua Bolton had worked for Goldman Sachs, and he helped to recruit Henry Paulson from Goldman to become Secretary of Treasury in 2006. Did either Bush or Cheney take a strong view on Paulson?
Well, Bush went out of his way to recruit Paulson at Josh Bolton's urging, no question about it. He personally wooed the guy in a way he didn't do with a lot of cabinet secretaries. And they ended up bonding, actually, Bush and Paulson, in a way he hadn't with his two previous Treasury secretaries.
And then Paulson seemed to bond with Ben Bernanke, who President Bush appointed to the chair of the Federal Reserve in early 2006. Were they looking for someone who would be different than Alan Greenspan?
Well, I think they were to some extent, and particularly also looking for somebody who's different than John Snow and Paul O'Neill, who had been the two Treasury secretaries. Josh Bolton says that in 2006 he worried that a crisis was coming and they needed somebody who had real Wall Street background. That's why he pursued Paulson so much. They just didn't know what the crisis was going
to
be.
But Paul O'Neill turned out to be a critic of the Bush administration.
Yeah, very much on the different page. The two did not get along personally. They didn't get along ideologically either. He resisted some of the tax cuts that President Bush wanted to put in place, thought they were the wrong idea.
In a recent documentary, Hank Paulson comes across as somebody who saw himself as almost independent of what was going on in the White House, that he was just pursuing what he thought was right, and every so often he got George Bush to go along with it.
Well, I mean, to some extent, that's true. Bush, in a way, treats Paulson the way he did Petraeus. He finds somebody who can be his general, in this case in the economic sphere, and take a front line position, because Bush recognizes his own political vulnerability at that point. His numbers are low in the polls. He needs somebody with Paulson's credibility to go out there and really lead the way, because otherwise it would be a potential disaster.
By late 2007, housing prices were steadily declining, and institutions like Bear Stearns were reporting huge losses on subprime mortgages. Greenspan, Paulson, Bernanke had all denied that there was a housing bubble or that there was trouble brewing. How did Bush or Cheney react to what was going on?
Well, I think they were worried about the economy. In fact, President Bush in the beginning of 2008 actually passes a stimulus package. We talk about stimulus with Obama. He passed a stimulus package with Nancy Pelosi in the Congress, one of the few times they got together, much smaller, obviously, than what Obama did. But they didn't recognize exactly how much this is going to ripple through the system the way it did.
Well, how did Bush and Cheney view economic policy? Were they on the same page regarding things like tax cuts or stimulus?
They were mostly on the same page. Cheney had a different view of what kind of tax cuts they should put in place. And by the end, they were both on the same side on TARP, but Cheney was on the opposite side on the auto bailout. He did not think it was government's role to go in there and rescue the Chrysler and GM.
I'm assuming that Bush felt a certain amount of pressure on tax cuts because of what happened to his father when he said, read my lips.
Yeah, he said, not only is this not read my lips, this is tax cuts come hell or high water, basically.
The NSA monitoring of American phone calls and emails began in the Bush years. What roles did Bush and Cheney have in devising that program?
Well, they're very aggressive on that. Coming in the first weeks after 9/11, they talked to Michael Hayden, then the head of the NSA, the National Security Agency, and said, what are you not doing that you should be doing? He said, I'm doing everything I can within the current limits. They said, well, that's not what we asked you. What are you not doing that you should be doing? So they began to push those limits, push those boundaries, and we're seeing the debate even today.
And Cheney actually saw it on a very personal level in 2007. Didn't he have doctors disable the wireless capabilities in his pacemaker because he feared that it could be hacked into?
Yeah, the doctor.
Later, Homeland uses that as a plot device.
Exactly right. There's a Wi-Fi element to the pacemaker. They didn't want terrorists or some nefarious person. And in fact, when they saw the Homeland show, Lynn Cheney called the next day and said, look, did you see what was on TV? It's exactly what we talked about.
Have either Bush or Cheney expressed a view of the Tea Party and its impact on American politics?
Cheney has said publicly that he thinks the Tea Party is a good force because at least it's creating a debate within the party. Bush hasn't said anything publicly much about it, but I think privately, according to people I've talked to, he's a little worried. It's sort of a reaction to his administration in some ways, as much as Obama's, because particularly in what he worries about is isolationism in the Tea Party movement.
Well, Cheney's daughter is running for Congress, so he has to be a lot more careful. Did he support the shutdown?
I don't know if he said specifically he was for the shutdown, but he certainly didn't question it the way others have. And Liz Cheney, no question, is trying to ride the wave of the Tea Party movement in a Republican primary. But it's kind of odd because she's really not a Tea Party person, at least on foreign policy. She's a real hawkish, in fact, even neoconservative advocate of democracy promotion and things like that the Tea Party is much more wary about.
But she's running to the right.
She is running to the right of Mike Enzi, the incumbent senator there. It's caused a real family feud there in Wyoming, a very small state.
An informal survey of the History News Network, by the History News Network of 109 historians found that over 95% thought that the Bush administration was one of the 10 worst presidencies in American history.
Yeah, no.
Do you think that's going to continue to be the assessment of historians?
I think for the present period, that that's not likely to change. I think President Bush hopes it will be a little bit more like Harry Truman, who also left office reviled a bad war, and but later was admired for putting in place a national security architecture that lasted beyond his administration for a new era. So he's hoping for that kind of a balance later in history.
Mark Leibovitz. Vitch was here to discuss the culture in Washington, and you're the Times White House correspondent. Did you feel any pressure to edit your work to preserve access to people that you will be relying on in the future?
No. The truth is that, if people are mad at you, they're going to be mad at you no matter what. You can't let that worry you. You have to just write what you can, and if you're honest and fair, that's all anybody can ask for.
Peter Baker's book is called Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. It is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.